This is from Welcome to the Machine, pages 112 through 121. In the 1990s, Oscar Gandhi took up where Foucault left off by describing the panoptic sort as, quote, the complex technology that involves the collection, processing, and sharing of information about individuals and groups that is generated through their daily lives as citizens, employees, and consumers, and is used to coordinate and control their access to the goods and services that define life in the modern capitalist economy, end quote. In other words, it's how those in power manage information that allows them to manage you, both collectively and individually. The more information they have, the more effectively they can manage you. And I need to point out that this was written before the existence of Facebook. The basis of the panoptic sort is the remote, invisible, automatic, and comprehensive sensing of personhood and the classification, evaluation, and sorting of individuals into groups for efficient training, rehabilitation, or elimination based on their value to the economic and political elite who control the sorting. The most highly valued are the rich and other rulers. They're given the primary fiscal benefits of the sorting system. Also high in the hierarchy are those trusted strategists who can make sense of the vast information apparatus. Below them are technicians who are privy to the data collected by the surveillance machines. Below that are the people of the middle class who enjoy enough benefits so that their sense of privilege outweighs their nagging feeling of never quite reaching the top. From the point of view of those who run the system, the value of the middle class is to provide the bulk of the surplus value. Below the middle class are working class people who run and maintain the machines that produce the consumer goods. They too enjoy enough benefits to keep them at work, to give them the illusion that they're living a good life, and to keep them from looking for a different way to live. And, as Henry Ford saw early on, it's essential in an industrial system to give at least some of the workers enough pay to buy at least some of what they build, or else the system's inevitable overproduction has no outlet. Toward the bottom of the value scale are those who are, quote, a little substance who carry the sick, bury the dead, clean and do many vile and abject offices, end quote. But even the unemployed and the homeless are of some value to the system. For example, they keep wages low by making the working class fearful of losing their jobs and by making sleeping under a bridge seem the only alternative to the treadmill of rent or mortgage. Below the value scale altogether are those who will not partake of the benefits of the system, the hunter-gatherers, the subsistence farmers who own their own land, the odd free spirit who won't settle for mortgage and salary. These are worse than useless to the system because they provide the system's servants with alternative visions and lifestyles. Because the existence of these alternatives cannot be tolerated lest the servants become restless, those who live these alternatives must be banished from the servants' view or destroyed altogether. This is where passports come in. Passports have been used for centuries for many purposes, to differentiate economic classes and religious and ethnic groups, to control serfs, to control travel across borders, to enforce military service, to collect taxes or other debts, to limit the labor pool, to monitor or immobilize the poor, the homeless, the unemployed, the criminals, to expel unwanted foreigners, to monitor the movement of citizens within the homeland, and to specify where the holder could and could not reside. The Russian nobility controlled the movement of its serfs by registering them with passports. 200 years later, the Soviet state used passports to enforce a collectivization more stringent, disempowering, and deadly than anything the old nobles could have dreamed up. Early in the 20th century, the British used passports to control the movement of Eastern European Jews. The French used passports to keep young men from escaping military conscription. Internal passports were a primary tool of South Africa's apartheid system. The Rwanda genocide of the 1990s used ethnic identity cards introduced by the colonial masters. In times of unrest, revolution, and war, the use of passports is ratcheted up. New classes of people are required to carry them. Anyone from the enemy nation, they might be a spy. Anyone eligible for military service, mustn't let them leave the country. Anyone who is traveling, who are they going to meet? These tighter standards are often not relaxed once peace returns. After World War I, the U.S. government made permanent the use of passports to exclude, quote, the undesirable, the enemy of law and order, the breeder of revolution, and the advocate of anarchy, end quote. In fact, why not have a national identity card for everyone? This shouldn't be a problem if, as the saying goes, you, quote, have nothing to hide, and you need hide nothing, end quote. The classic argument in favor of the continued ratcheting up of restrictions after World War I was articulated by the British trade unionist W.L. George. In his April 6, 1919 Sunday Times editorial, he wrote that, quote, secrecy is hateful, it breeds evils, and I would that all houses might be made of glass, end quote. Take note of what he has done here. By shaming the reader, he attempts to skirt the central truth that secrecy and evil come not from houses so much as from the fortresses and armories of bureaucracy. If you buy into his argument, and too many people do, it's easy to ask, why shouldn't the identity card and a national register be seen as, quote, hallmarks of efficient modern bureaucracy and not an emergency measure, end quote. Early passports contained the holder's name and hometown, but names were easily changed, despite the laws of European states forbidding it, so the traveler's permanent features such as scars or tattoos were also recorded. Well into the 19th century, branding and ear docking were common ways to identify criminals, Roma, indigents, and the insane. Jeremy Bentham, architect of the Panopticon, recommended that everyone be tattooed as a, quote, new spring for morality, a new source of power for the laws, an almost infallible precaution against a multitude of offenses, end quote. Bentham was an incurable optimist of a sort. The technology for such a thorough system was more than a century away, and even in Bentham's time, branding and other gross methods were beginning to be frowned upon. Administrators faced a difficult problem. They needed something that didn't hurt so much when administered and that didn't reveal the coercive power of the sorting machine. Luckily for them, anthropometry, the study of human body measurements, especially on a comparative basis, fingerprints, and photography were soon discovered and used. Within 10 years of the invention of photography, the Swiss and German police had taken hundreds of thousands of photographs of Roma and other unemployed, useless, and homeless, mortgage-free people. By 1840, France decreed that all nomads, those without, quote, domicile or fixed abode, end quote, itinerants, and, quote, Romanies, end quote, who were accused of poaching, theft, bestiality, and stealing children, should have their height, chest, arm span, head, and left foot measured, their eye color and fingerprints recorded, and their photographs taken. It wouldn't do much good to measure their growing children, but everyone down to the age of 2 years was to have all 10 fingerprints recorded. The, quote, Romanies, end quote, were accused of stealing children, but who in fact was taking control of other children's identities? The bureaucrat's problem quickly became the sorting and retrieval of a particular photo from the hundreds of thousands that had been collected. So many unemployed people roaming the land and so few bureaucrats. With their disregard for the supposed benefits of supposedly gainful labor, the unemployed certainly weren't to be trained. How then were they to be followed and controlled? Discrimination is easy. So is building a database. Retrieval and sense-making are the trick. It's a big world out there, full of people and politics and uncontrolled behavior. And until we eliminate them, lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Sorting them all to pick out certain ones is the big challenge. Our culture has opted for the easy way out, bring in the machines. That's what the Nazis did. They had a problem. How are they to keep track of millions of Jews and other undesirables? They turned to IBM and its Hollerith machines. Quote, as early as 1934, various government bureaus began to compile card catalogs identifying political and racial enemies of the regime, such as Freemasons, Jews, Sinti and Roma, and genetically diseased persons. Actually, governments have been doing this for more than a century, but no mind. The 1939 census became the basis for a national register of Jews. That year, German census forms for the first time included explicitly racial, Sikh, categories. Jews were identified not only by religious affiliation, but by race as well. Within 3 years, the complicated National Register of Jews and some Jewish Mischlinge, mixed breeds, was to become one of the sources for Nazi deportation lists. The Nazi regime employed thousands of people in 1933 to 1939 to record national census data onto Hollerith punch cards. The SS used the Hollerith machines during the war to monitor the large number of prisoners shipped in and out of concentration camps. The machines were manufactured by DHOMAG, Deutsche Hollerith Maschinengesellschaft, or German Hollerith Machine Company, a subsidiary of IBM since 1922. Let's bring this up to date. Like the French passes for Roma, the border crossing and green cards that the U.S. government issues to Mexican citizens display fingerprints and photos. But in this dangerous post-9/11 world, or to be more precise, in this world where those in power have seized upon the excuse of 9/11 to increase their power to surveil and control. Those in power are getting much more sophisticated. By October 2004, all foreign visitors to the United States had to have visas and passports that included computer chips with facial recognition data. Travelers' fingers and faces could then be scanned to compare with the digital data on their passports. By 2006, all new passports issued to U.S. citizens were also to contain the chips. Currently, there are 55 million U.S. passports, with another 7 million issued every year. The term used for all this technology is biometrics. It's just what it sounds like, the measurement of living beings. Each of us is unique, and various economic and political authorities, using their handmaidens, science and technology, are finding many ways to measure various bits and pieces of us. Your face, fingerprints, irises and retinas, wrist vein patterns, DNA, handwriting, voice, and gait can all be recorded, measured, analyzed, and identified. Note, of course, that none of this is who you are. Just as identity theft reduces us to our bank account, biometrics reduces us to our fingerprints. Technically, much of this is a piece of cake, and the only reason the feds don't already have your wrist vein patterns on file, presuming they don't, is because, as the New York Times puts it, quote, the adoption of biometric technologies has been held back for years by concerns about privacy and reliability, along with a lack of uniform standards. But policies and standards have begun to catch up with the technologies. Quote, policies and standards have begun to catch up with the technologies, end quote. Doesn't this phrase sound familiar? Isn't this how it always goes? Many who have explored technology, surveillance, and bureaucracy, we're thinking here of Max Weber, Jacques Ellul, Christopher Dandeker, and others, have come to the same realization, that the advance of technology is relentless, and that it's impossible to control surveillance with laws and regulations. Who, or what, is in charge here? Don't worry, though, whisper the voices inside your head. At least you think they're inside your head, but you're not quite so sure anymore. The passport chips will be encrypted, and even though it involves face recognition software, the system will be, quote, very user-friendly. It's unobtrusive. This was said by Dennis Shagnon, an official at the International Civil Aviation Organization, the United Nations agency that set an international standard for biometric passports in May 2003. He also said, quote, what was required was a globally interoperable biometric, one biometric that could be used worldwide and could be read worldwide, end quote. Under the new standards, governments will be able to add additional biometric technologies to passports, like fingerprints or iris scans. As its name indicates, the passport was originally used to authorize travel by sea. Thanks to the UN's International Labor Organization, more than a million workers on ships around the world will soon have biometric identification cards that store digital fingerprints and photographs in a two-dimensional barcode. The passport, being the property of the state, can be withdrawn at any time, thus revoking the privileges of travel, work, residence, and identity. Jeremy Bentham keeps reminding us that the central question is not your question, who am I, but the one directed at you, who are you with whom I, the bureaucrat, have to deal? This is from an interrogation manual. The manner and timing of arrest can contribute substantially to the interrogator's purposes. What we aim to do is to ensure that the manner of arrest achieves, if possible, surprise, and the maximum amount of mental discomfort in order to catch the suspect off balance and to deprive him of the initiative. One should therefore arrest him at a moment when he least expects it and when his mental and physical resistance is at its lowest. The ideal time in which to arrest a person is in the early hours of the morning, because surprise is achieved then, because a person's resistance physiologically as well as psychologically is at its lowest. We don't track Roma anymore, but we're still interested in the unemployed, the poor, and the hungry. In 1996, the Connecticut legislature passed a law requiring that the two index fingerprints of every existing and new welfare recipient be scanned and databased with a computer, not an ink pad. No muss, no fuss. It would be done to prevent people from receiving welfare benefits under more than one name or from receiving benefits improperly from more than one town or state program. Those poor people are still poaching from the king's larder, and it's got to stop. The fact that no pretense is made of stopping the far greater thefts from the Treasury by corporations, quote, receiving benefits improperly, end quote, hints at the real purpose of this information gathering. In standard bureaucratic form, a survey was taken of the new program. 88.4% of the respondents felt they had not been inconvenienced by the finger imaging process. 85.1% did not object to the process. and 87.1% felt that the process would indeed help prevent people from cheating the welfare program. Perhaps the welfare recipients felt themselves in no position to protest. Certainly, had they spoken out against the program, they would have been reminded that the receipt of welfare benefits is purely voluntary. If they did not wish to give their fingerprints, no one would put a gun to their head and force them to apply for assistance. The state knew the program might be controversial elsewhere, since, quote, public perception and the association of fingerprinting with the criminal element was pervasive, end quote. Using society's obsession with technology to gloss over what was happening, the Department of Social Services had early on determined that the project should be referred to as digital imaging, with a focus on the digital technology rather than fingerprinting alone. The Department of Social Services opponents characterized the system as invasive and dehumanizing. And their response? A press conference during which the Connecticut governor, followed by state legislator Jean Garvey, the mother of digital imaging, the DSS commissioner and deputy commissioner, and several other state officials were the first to be imaged. DSS is confident that, quote, the demonstration of the application of the technology was straightforward and the value apparent to all, end quote. So who's next? The answer, 84,000 adult recipients of public assistance from 169 towns. The state believes, quote, the connection of the system to ID card issuance and its possible future use in the nationwide EBT infrastructure would position the project as a model for the future of human services benefit delivery systems, end quote. Connecticut is small potatoes. The British National DNA database has 2 million profiles for more than 5 million sets of fingerprints. Authorities are seeking new powers that would allow police to take DNA and fingerprint samples whenever a person is arrested, not just if that person is actually charged with a crime. A court ruling states that the DNA of people who have been cleared of any involvement in a crime can be retained. The benefit to society? If a suspect's DNA is put through the system, 38% of crimes are solved, compared with an overall figure of 24%. The U.S. Combined DNA Index System, established by the FBI in 1990, enables federal, state, and local crime labs to exchange and compare DNA profiles electronically. Not to worry, whisper those voices in your head. If you don't do anything wrong, you have nothing to fear, right? Right? The point is that we should never be deceived that technologies are neutral. They're controlled by those in power, which means those in power have the ability to gain access to information about those under their power, whether or not those under their power desire this information known. This information is then used to reward those the powerful choose to reward and to harm those they wish to harm. At the same time, those not in power do not have access to the same sort of information about those in power. Within this rubric, information, like power, is a one-way street and a dead-end one at that.